That sounds rough.
Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is AppSats Radio, help for partners after sexual betrayal. We talk about it here.
Betrayal trauma.
We are AppSat certified clinical partner specialists and coaches who have been trained to help navigate you through this crisis. There is nothing we won't talk about.
So I've got Amy on the line. Amy, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Well, I have a question about what healthy sexuality looks like when a sex addict is in recovery.
One of the things we know about research and sex addicts is that they don't necessarily want sex with their own wife. And so to me, that says he's in really good recovery because he does want that with you. He has been 2 years sober. He has been in 3 facilities. And I suspect that's how he's wanting closeness with you.
That is right. I suspect that is what is happening for Amy, is that, you know, one of the things I know is it's imperative if you're working on your relationship that you try to rebuild your sexual self. Now, that may be by yourself because you may have kicked the addict to the curb. Or it might be because you're in the interim and you need to be taking care of your own needs in addition to deciding when does it feel safe to be sexual again with him. Hi, I'm Carol Jurgensen-Sheets, a.k.a. Carol the Coach, and I am so happy to be with you today. We're talking today to Michelle, and Michelle was on a couple of years ago, maybe not quite that long ago, telling her story, and she really wanted to come back on because she felt like there was more to add to the story. So I'm going to ask her to give you a brief of what happened to her, and then we're going to continue the saga of Michelle's life as a partner with a husband who was ravaged by sexual addiction. So, Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carol.
Yes. I wondered if you could share with them just a brief overview. I know it's years and years and years, but tell them a little bit about what you had to deal with.
Okay, well, first of all, I had no idea, absolutely no clue what my husband was doing. He was fantastic, fantastic at lying, you know, or just compartmentalizing, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
And when I found out, I finally checked the credit card statements because I didn't realize we had so many. And what he was doing was filtering money through the bank account to pay the credit cards. And I thought, oh, you know, he really wants to pay the bills. That's cool. Instead, he was pulling out cash withdrawals, living his second life. Not only did I find out from the credit cards, but probably the worst horror anybody can go through when they find out this, he was being blackmailed. Not imagine. That meant that the only way to get rid of the blackmailer was I had to take action.
Well, so now, wait. My goodness, this does not usually happen to all partners. So you said you were blackmailed, and I'd like to know, how did you find out you were being blackmailed?
When I came with the credit cards, and I saw the cash advances and just, you know, bills for this or that, that just didn't make sense. First thing out of his mouth was, I'm being blackmailed. That was like the most important thing on his mind.
Mm-hmm. And so you got suspicious and you asked him about it, and he confessed immediately. But not to necessarily sex addiction. He confessed to being blackmailed. So what was this person doing?
Just extorting money. Probably every, just whenever, you know, whenever he felt like it, he would send a text, hey, I need money, you know, I want money. And then when I found out and he wasn't getting any more money, Well, that's when I guess you could say everything hit the fan.
Okay, so one of the things I know when I'm working with a sex addict, I always ask them to surmise how much money they spent on sex addiction. Do you have any idea how much money he spent totally on his sex addiction?
Well, we have, I think he spent well over $150,000, maybe even $200,000. And you have to add in another $350,000 that was retirement, and that's completely gone now. His credit cards are maxed out. My credit cards have been maxed out, and I'm pretty nervous.
Okay, so you're not just talking about the expense of the sexual addiction, that whatever this person was requesting from him, but you're also talking about the financial cost of what it cost you as a family because of his sex addiction. I mean, I know the man lost his job, right?
Yes.
And that was a six-figure job.
Yes.
And I know that he went into treatment and actually went into some very, very good treatment to the tune of how many months was he in treatment?
He was gone 4 months, and I would estimate that we spent $75,000 total.
Mm, okay. And then you started living off your retirement because all of a sudden he didn't have a job.
Yes.
And now you're saying you have no more retirement. That was about $350,000?
Yes, but we also had to pay the penalty for the withdrawal.
Oh, yeah.
And then it is taxed as income. So not only do we owe our debt, but we also owe the IRS a lot of money.
So he had this addiction bad. And I know that it was an unusual addiction in that he was flirting and grooming with lots and lots of people, both at work and on the streets. But he also had a fetish. Can you tell our listening audience what the fetish was?
Yes. It was African-American transsexuals.
Oh.
And that is actually who was blackmailing us, an African-American transsexual.
Okay, so again, we're not making the African-American point, but it was a transsexual. You are Caucasian, so is your husband. So his fetish was for somebody that he normally would not have been, that would not have been available to him through his dating life, his adolescence, all that stuff. And what I think is one of the biggest traumas is that that person contacted you multiple times. So before we continue the story, I know you want to continue from the last time we talked. What was it like to be contacted by this person?
I was in fear. I was in fear for me. I was in fear for my children. We didn't know what was going to happen. I called the police. The police said they could not do anything.
Uh-huh.
I went to the courthouse to get an order of protection. The judge denied that. There was nothing I could do, and he kept calling the house. He called my employment, and in the end, yes, I did have to speak to him. Actually, we texted, and he wanted to FaceTime, but we didn't have the same computer software to do that, so I took a picture of myself holding his text and sent that, and that was good enough for him. And he did a few other things to make sure that, his point was made. And he had said his goal was to break up our marriage, which 2.5 years, we're still actually married.
And allegedly, this happened the first time your husband ever was with him.
Oh, yes, before he even reached the car.
So he gets to the car, he pays his money, he gets to the car, and there is this threatening text to your husband that says what?
I have this picture, and I'm sure your wife would not want to see this.
Okay. And so your husband then was dealing with the trauma of, oh my gosh, this is somebody that's going to hold me hostage to my own sex addiction and to my money. And this went on for about how long?
3 years.
Okay. 3 years. Got it. And so you found out, because you got curious, he confessed he was being blackmailed. Would it be fair to say you really were almost in the fetal position on the floor? You were devastated.
Yes, I had no idea, no clue. I had put my complete faith into this person. I told everybody, I'm married to the smartest man I've ever met, and he treats me like a queen. And I praised him to all of my friends and my family.
Okay, so again, there's so much betrayal here. I mean, obviously there's a betrayal of sex addiction. There's a betrayal of not knowing who you've lived with for how many years before the discovery?
We were just past our 19th wedding anniversary, so we were together a little over 20 years.
Okay, and you had a couple of kids from this marriage. You thought you were happily married, and good, responsible job. He made good money. You thought you were being treated like a queen, and you were that part of his life. But there was this whole dark side. And, you know, you and I have worked together before, and you have said, oh, there was nothing that would have indicated that he was a sex addict, to your knowledge. But there were times that he was not as sensitive or understanding as you would have liked him to be. There were things that you were angry about.
Absolutely. In fact, he wasn't that interested in me sexually, our whole relationship. I always, maybe not always, but most of the time, I initiated. And I just figured I married a man with a low sex drive. And after several years, I felt like this man is always mad at me. Not quite angry, but mad. Like when I would say walking and mumble and I have to walk past or after him and say, you know, what did you say? The topic of his job was off limits. And when I would invite him to do something with the family, he'd throw his arms in the air and say he was too busy. But yet, I could turn around and see him on the sofa watching sports.
Mm-hmm. So you said earlier, he treated you like a queen. And yet, talking about it there is indicative of you two having marital problems. Now, first and foremost, to our listening audience, I do not in any way want you all to think that I am saying she's responsible for his sex addiction, because she is in no way responsible. I don't care what was going on in their relationship. A man's sexual addiction is about him. It is not about the partner. So it's not about you, Michelle, and it's not about our listening audience. Yet, you could say two things. You could say he treated me like a queen, and then you could tell me these things that were problematic in the marriage. So you, in some ways, compartmentalized some of the problems. I mean,
it's true. I thought I was looking at a person and thinking, that's just who he is. Mm-hmm. I need to accept who he is. That's how he is, and that's how he behaves. I live with him, and I will.
And certainly what I know is that is what people are supposed to do in a normal, healthy marriage, is accept those character flaws about somebody else. I mean, that is what they're supposed to do. And so I don't blame you. You actually were practicing what I call good coping skills in a marriage. You just kind of accept people for their differences. And you had some issues, too, that we are not necessarily going to go into, but you had some special needs, I will say, that I think made you doubt yourself too. Some mental health needs.
Absolutely. And it actually made me think that, okay, he's this way, but I am not capable of many things. I felt like I needed him to guide my life. I felt like, how do I do something? He needs to be in charge. He's the head of the household. And when it came to basically anything, yes, I did doubt myself, and I would fall into deep depressions. And the deep depressions led to him having to do probably 3/4 of the household. He would clean, he would cook, but yet I could tell he had resentment for that. But yet I couldn't manage to do that. I went through many medication changes.
Mm-hmm.
I tried. I did my best before we got married. Actually, I explained this to him. I said, this is what I have, and I want you to know this. He was willing. He took a class, a family-to-family class on
depression and mental health issues.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So that he would know what to expect,
mm-hmm.
how to relate. And I thought, I have met a man that normally doesn't exist. I mean, he was willing to take me as I was. 20 years ago, people did not view mental health the same.
Mm-hmm.
And here's this man who's willing to take a class to know how to help me.
And so, obviously, you were very grateful. And when you'd go into depression, he would take over. And that had to make you feel extra grateful. But also, what he did was take advantage of you during that depression. So here he was helping you out. But he also utilized that time to work extra hours, which he wasn't always working. He was doing a lot of flirting and grooming and asking out and all sorts of things. He was acting out all over the place. And so now I want to bring you back up to, you find out you're in the fetal position. You're wondering what you're going to do. He's going to get help. He's going to go for intensive help. And those 4 months that he was gone, what did you find out about yourself?
I found out that I was able to take care of the children. It seemed like the children were better behaved, although my daughter was very angry. She internalized it. But it seemed like bedtime was easier. It was easier to have them eat the dinner that I prepared. It was a much quieter house. I had friends that I did not have before.
Mm-hmm.
I had other people to rely on. Not necessarily that I relied on them, that I added them into my life as an independent person.
Okay. And so you learned that you could take care of yourself regardless of the situation, and that was actually a confidence booster for you, right?
Yes.
And then he came back. And what was he like when he came back out of treatment?
He was the nicest person. I could not believe how nice he was. And I was waiting. Who's this nice person? I don't know you. When are you going to change back?
So you didn't necessarily trust it.
Absolutely, I did not.
Okay. So continue on with your story, because it's been now, been in recovery how long?
He's been in recovery 1.5 years.
Okay. And how's he doing?
He became complacent.
Okay.
And I explained that to him because I could see it happening. I could see the procrastination, which is a sign. When I would ask about relapse, the percentage of relapse is high with this. I would ask, and, oh, well, that doesn't happen to people that went to the rehab where I went. And I'm like, well, going to group therapy and doing Zoom, because now we're in Zoom.
We're doing that virtual thing, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yuck-ola.
So he's doing his classes through that. I wouldn't say they're classes, but they're groups.
Mm-hmm.
And they're peers.
Sessions.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Groups and peers, but he's not doing individual therapy. He did two times. And I had told him, you're not working on yourself. He had a little too much arrogance. And then it happened, not a full acting out, but it is what he considers a slip. I consider it a little bit more important than that. He did have an internet lookup of a past partner on video.
So it was a past affair partner that he chose to look up. Now, I'm just asking, don't you have covenant eyes or something to keep you informed if he slips?
I do, but this was not pornographic. There was nothing to censor.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it'd be like, well, it wasn't a Facebook, because doesn't Facebook also show up on Covenant Eyes or some of the filtering systems?
Well, he doesn't have Facebook. This was YouTube.
Okay, got it. And we all know that YouTube can take you to some really dark places just naturally if somebody is looking and perusing. But you're saying that he was curious about an affair partner and he looked him or her up.
Exactly. A Google search as well as the YouTube search. And in my opinion, the YouTube search not only shows, oh, I clicked on this video and then I clicked off. You have about 8 images that pop up with that. And you see all those images and you're taking yourself back into that world. You've invited that right back into your life. Oh, but it didn't hurt anybody is what he was thinking. He did not tell his sponsor. He did not tell anyone. In fact, I did not find it from snooping. I actually found it because I was trying to reload the Covenant Eyes because I had put a new payment information. So I needed to do a reboot.
Uh-huh.
This is how I found that, because I was not snooping. I'm my own person. I found that. I asked him, oh, well, look at this. And his reply was gaslighting. How'd that get there? And then suddenly, you know, of course, he's yelling at me. And it became my fault.
And, you know, that could have gaslighted her. It could have made her feel as if she was crazy. But that is a perfect example of DARVO. And DARVO stands for, it's an acronym. D is deny. He's denied that he did anything. You, instead of owning it himself. R is for reverse. He reversed the roles on you. Instead of him being the perpetrator, he made you the perpetrator. V is that he becomes the victim. How could you think that about me? Why would you do that? And then O is you become the offender. And that's DARVO, D-A-R-V-O. Deny, attack, reverse, victim, and offender. And so did you find yourself explaining yourself, or did you know what he was doing immediately? Because you're pretty wise. You've been at this a couple years.
No, I knew. The minute he started to try to walk out of the room, you deny, deny, deny. Get out of the room as fast as you can. That's the pattern.
That was his MO.
Exactly. And I looked at him and I said, this is exactly what you've done in the past. He sat down on the sofa, put his head down, and yes, I did do that. And I said, how many times? Twice? How many people? Well, no other people. He was being honest.
Mm-hmm.
He took accountability.
Okay. So once he was caught, then he took accountability and he became honest. And you really feel like you got the full story.
I do. But it's unfortunate that he did explode. He did yell at me. He did mention divorce. My children heard this. And that breaks both of our hearts we tried to explain, no, everything's okay. You know, you don't need to worry. Mm. Our children don't need to worry. You're safe. Mm. You're fine. They did not know the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And my wish is that they never know the subject.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, you've been through so much. And, you know, I'm wondering what these last 2 years have been for you, because he got out of treatment. He was an incredibly nice guy. I remember you saying to me, oh, my gosh, I'm looking out the window. He's playing ball with our son. In the course of history, I've never seen him play ball. And he's really trying to be the family man that I would like him to be. And that lasted for a while. And you seemed to be getting better. You really did. You were doing really well. And then you took a turn for the worse. Do you remember what threw you back into real partner betrayal?
Oh, yes, I remember exactly. I was doing much better. I had held on to his previous phone number because I myself have control issues, and that dates back from my childhood, how I grew up. And my control is fear. Fear of abandonment. I kept that phone number for a full year. I was finally ready to get rid of the phone number. I turned on the phone, but there was a text from a previous affair.
And when you say a text, how long ago do you think that text had occurred? It had a date, didn't it?
Yes, it was recent.
Okay.
And this person had not been contacted by my husband in 2 years.
Uh-huh.
Of course, I did ruminate, and I had to know what was going on.
Of course.
And I answered the text. And the first sentence from this person was an invitation to her bed after 2 years. And I explained, I'm sorry, but this is his wife, and she's his wife, and that she did admit to knowing that he was married, but she did not admit to her activity. But I told her I knew, and she apologized.
Uh-huh.
She said, thank you. You woke me up. This is not how I want to be. And I told her, I said, you need to understand that next time the person on the other end might not be so gracious. We ended the call, and I changed the phone number. I did ask my husband to find somewhere else to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
He has been on the sofa since.
So that was a personal boundary that you maintained because it threw you right back into not feeling safe. Now, I want to share with our listening audience that it wasn't necessarily her husband's fault that he had been contacted by this other woman. It is the collateral damage of sex addiction that your past can haunt you and people can show up in your life even when you're in good recovery. And that's what happened to Michelle's husband. But the truth of the matter is the body keeps score, and Michelle's brain and her body didn't know the difference between the pain of the past and what she had just experienced when she saw the text. And that is such a dilemma.
That's a light bulb moment for me, mm-hmm. because I have been in physical pain, aches and pains that I've never had before.
Mm.
I had mentioned this to a friend, and she said, you are holding on to anger. This is affecting your physical body. When you can let this go, you will feel better. I have been working on that. What I have been working on is myself. I have not been working on our relationship, but I need to feel better mentally and physically.
Now, I have to admit, you have had a lot of calamities to your health. This woman got bit by a spider and could have lost her leg, and you run so much and do such a beautiful job at triathlons and all that stuff that you've had issues with your joints. And yet, what I know to be true is that physical exercise does really help you emotionally, physically, and spiritually. Wouldn't you agree?
100%. 100%. And that is how I have started my new life. I'm so excited. The thought of going into something new, I've been a domestic goddess mm-hmm. for over 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I am branching out for myself, by myself, and I am starting my own company, and it does have to deal with exercise, and it's up to me to grow the business, but I am exercising every day because I need to be able to lead my company. So this is very exciting for me. It's terrifying on the other hand too.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something that I need to do. I'm thrilled. I'm absolutely thrilled and terrified.
Mm-hmm. So you said a light bulb moment because it reminded you, it shed a light, if you will, on the fact that your body has been keeping score and that you have been holding on to anger and that it has been showing up in different physical and emotional, maybe even spiritual ways. But you are moving forward in your life. And you remember I talked to you about those three phases that APSAT so believes in, that safety and stabilization phase, that anger, grief, mourning, and loss stage, and then that post-traumatic growth stage. And, you know, if that's 1 to 10, 1 to 3 is safety and stabilization, 4 to 6, yeah, 4 to 6 is all that grief, mourning, and anger, and then 7 to 9 is post-traumatic growth, what number would you give yourself?
7 to 9, although I regress many times. Sometimes in the same day, I'll go through all three.
Mm-hmm.
I do remind myself of something. I don't do anything about our relationship. We're good friends. We're not lovers anymore, but we're very good friends. We like each other. You know, my life is not in danger. You know, he would never physically harm me. And we need to parent together. You know, we still have the family unit. But me not doing anything is and was my problem. And there was something that I read. Your comfort zone will kill you. So doing this new company is stepping out of my comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I would say 7 to 9. As long as I'm only concentrating on myself.
Well, and obviously you had a good point, which is I asked you where you were, and I thought you might say, oh, I got 1 foot in 4 to 6, and I got 1 foot in 7 to 9, and you probably do. But the truth of the matter is you can go back and forth into all three of those phases several times a day, and that's why when you open that phone and there was a text, even though that was not your husband's fault present, it was his past following him around, and it threw you right back into safety and stabilization. You were sitting there thinking, oh, my gosh, how long am I going to have to deal with this? How much of this am I going to have to deal with? Who else is going to contact us? Even if I shut down my phone number, his phone number, and we get another phone number, is somebody else going to find us? I mean, that blackmailer was relentless. He was all over the place trying to get a hold of both you and your husband.
Exactly. But I'm not scared of the blackmailer. If he wants to come back, that's fine. You know, I told my husband, I'm like, look, it's not the end of the world. The whole town's not going to read your name and discuss you.
Mm-hmm.
I've already been the lowest of the low that I can feel. There's nothing left that he can do.
That's a very, very good point. And I love how you're taking charge of your own life. You are practicing the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And what you're changing is your own self-care, your own self-identity, your own life. You are putting together something, a new business, that you're going to be able to focus on instead of all that garbage from your past.
Exactly. I do focus on that. But I also know that being married to him, mm-hmm. he does not remember everything that he did. He says he does. There's absolutely no way. His brain was in a complete fog.
Mm-hmm.
I know I will find out more information in the future. I know I will find surprises. And I know that I need to be ready for that.
Mm-hmm.
This breaks my heart. There's nothing more that I want than to have that feeling of falling in love with him again, renewing our vows, and this fantasy in my life that I have to realize where I am in life. And I'm not there. I might not ever be there. And that's okay. None of this was my fault.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, to my listening audience, every client that I've ever had has one unique story that has always, it always has taught me something, but it has always been special to the client. And Michelle, I have one about you, and it had to do with the disclosure. Do you trust me to tell it on air?
Nope, that's fine. Okay. I don't mind.
So many of you know I do disclosures, and 99 out of 100. I've done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. 99 out of 100 go really well. The partner gets information that she didn't have, but she's able to handle it because it's not so much the information. It is about knowing the truth. And, of course, it's followed by a polygraph test. And so Michelle went through this horrendous ordeal of a disclosure. How many questions did you have for this disclosure, Michelle? Now, I'm telling you, if you're doing disclosures, getting prepared right now, do not follow her path. She asked way too many questions. It wasn't good for her brain. But you had how many questions?
I had 256 because I did a complete outline of exactly what I was thinking, how I was thinking it, what I wanted to know,
mm-hmm.
and I had 4 months to think about this.
Yes, because he was in treatment, and the disclosure happened after he got home. So she has this intensive amount of information she wants to know, and she really heard most of it, and she'd have to ask him to stop because you could see her brain was on overload, but she was handling it really, really well. And then the thing that upset her the most, that got her to stop and crumble, was not about transgender relationships or prostitutes or sleeping with men or any of the many things that it could have been. Michelle found out that he had had a sexual encounter in the parking lot where she bought her running equipment and her running gear. Now, do I have that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And that, of everything, affected her the most in our disclosure because he had now contaminated her special place, her happy place, the thing that brings her the most joy. And she sat in that disclosure devastated. Again, not hearing about transgendered relationships, not hearing about prostitutes, not hearing about strip clubs, but about having that place sabotaged emotionally for her. And I didn't know if she was going to make it. Did you, Michelle?
I was, the whole disclosure, in shock and awe. When he said that made me angry.
Mm-hmm.
The rest, I had no idea. I couldn't believe it. But that made me angry. And especially, he already knew how special that place was to me.
Mm-hmm.
He knew that, but yet he did that anyway.
Well, we say that's an addict behavior. They do whatever is closest, most convenient, easiest, and they don't think about the ramifications of the issues that it could cause. And so when the disclosure was over, I sent him away and I sat with her and we processed things. And it was about 3 hours into it. And I said, okay, now we need to go. And she started to leave and she walked maybe 10 feet down the hall. And she just leaned up against the wall and slid down the wall and crumbled to the floor. And I literally had to pick her up by her arms and stand her back up and, you know, remind her she was going to make it and that she could do it. And after about 20 minutes, which included also being in the parking lot, beating the ground, she was very angry. I put her in my car, and Michelle was smart enough that she had set up for a hotel room 2 minutes from my office and her support group to meet her later for the day. So you can imagine that I, as the therapist, was so devastated for her, and I was worried about her, and I wasn't sure she'd make it. And I knew how heartbroken she was about her special place. And the good news is I walked her into the hotel. We got her set up. I left her. And 4 hours later, I got a picture or two or three of she and her group doing a selfie, smiling big, and supporting each other. And it really stressed how important it is to have support. And you did have support. You even invited them to have a slumber party at the hotel if they wanted. You met somebody the next day for breakfast. I mean, you knew how to do it up. What do you think that is about you that has that kind of resiliency?
Well, I figured, well, if this is going to be one of the worst times in my life, let's just turn it into a party. Okay. So you've heard of divorce parties. I said, well, ladies, I'm doing a disclosure party, so why don't you meet me for dinner? And they did, and we had a nice time. One of the girls stayed with me. She did stay till 1 a.m., came back. We had breakfast.
Uh-huh.
They called me. You know, I couldn't ask for better help. If I had invited my friends that did not understand,
uh-huh,
that would not have been supportive for me. I guess I was the only one that has ever done a disclosure party. I knew it was going to be devastating. I didn't know it was going to be as devastating as it was. So it was a good thing I had set up a disclosure party.
Mm-hmm. No kidding. You knew how to do it up, and she did it right. And that's why if you are going to do a disclosure, have that support set up. And if you've already been through that disclosure and you don't have the happy story that Michelle had, because remember, it was very, very bittersweet, look for ways to find support today. And you have struggled with support since then. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Groups can have philosophies that don't necessarily endorse everything you believe in. I mean, there's a lot of talk about codependency or stay on your side of the street. And you and I, Michelle, and my listening audience knows that this is a relational issue. And you have every right to know your husband's treatment, as do you as a couple have the right to be open, honest, transparent, and authentic with each other, even if it means talking about the hard stuff, right?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. So as we begin to wrap up the show, what would you like to tell our listening audience?
The last time I told the listening audience that forgiveness is not about forgetting the past, but freeing yourself. I am still working on that. I am still working on letting go of the anger.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still working on accepting the fact that I am not in charge. My higher power, which is God, is in charge. And I need to trust in that. I need to trust in myself. Who I need to believe in the most, first of all, is God. The second of all, I need to believe in myself most. I was wrong in putting my belief into my husband. That's a lot of pressure to put all your belief into somebody else. The person that's receiving that, it's difficult. I understand. I need to live my own life and trust in God and myself.
Very well said. And as you can see, Michelle has a lot of resiliency and is one of the brightest women I've ever met. She's a stay-at-home mom, but I have no doubt that she's going to put this company together and make it her own because it's something she loves to do, and it has to do with athletics and movement and exercise and fun. So, Michelle, I wish you the best. Come back in a year. Let us know what you're doing. Because actually, you requested, you said, can I come back on and continue the saga? Because it is a saga, isn't it?
It is. It's almost like a cliffhanger. Well, what's going to happen yet? My forgiveness, it's minimal. Mm-hmm. I do feel empathy for him. I'm sure this is not how he wanted to live. But it's a daily struggle.
Well, it is. And, you know, you're talking about forgiveness. And I was just listening to the best podcast on forgiveness. And I'm going to read you something that I actually sent to myself because it was so good. You know, we at APSAT tell women they do not have to believe that they need to forgive. That's an individual choice. Some women never forgive. Other women practice that principle and are always in the process. And some women, especially my partner betrayal post-traumatic growth course, they did find forgiveness. But I wrote this down. I can't remember his name, but he's a psychologist, and he said forgiveness is keeping up the hope that your past could ever have been different. And what he meant by that is once you let go of that hope that your life could have been different, more likely to forgive. So I don't think I said that exactly right at the beginning, but truly, if you want to forgive, you have to give up the hope that your past could ever have been any different. And I always say you have to use reframing. You have to put yourself out of that victim role and say, how am I stronger? What have I learned? How can I move forward? And Michelle, you're the spitting image of that. You are moving forward in your life. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it. And so we're wrapping up for today. But as I say at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times. So fearlessly, like Michelle, have the courage to be yourself. And we will see you next week for more Betrayal Recovery Radio here at APSATS.org.
For more information, go to APSATS.org, the Association of Partners of Sex Addicts Trauma Specialists, to find a professional in your area who is trained to help you after sexual betrayal.